Welcome back to the Fundamentals of Application Lifecycle Management. I'm Stephen Borg.
And I'm James Tupper.
And we're going to be talking quality. Let's jump right in. It's the third of four modules. After this one, we're going to be taking a break for lunch to come back and then talk about visibility. Quality is a team sport, quality techniques, and then specifically testers and quality assurance. Those are the three areas we're going to cover during this module. And that's just a quick overview. I think it's important, though, to remember that quality is a team sport. It is not the responsibility of one individual. It's the responsibility of all. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at a Kanban board. Here's your traditional Kanban board laying all up there, and you can see the flow through there. But I want to direct your attention to the tops of each of those transitions. Quality. I do too. This is critical that everyone take a role in quality. In an application lifecycle management world or a DevOps world, quality is the responsibility of everyone. You can see right across here, it is for everyone. It's more than just testing. If you don't see that already, go back and fix that first. Testing, you cannot test quality into a product.
No.
I mean, you just can't do that. You can test to validate that the quality is in the product, but testing in and of itself doesn't provide the quality. So everyone's responsible for that quality, all the way from the business analyst to the person pushing it to the production to the person watching it in production. Let's take a look at what some of those might be. For instance, business analysts. What do they need to do? They need to create measurable requirements and provide fast feedback for questions the devs provide. Devs. This one's pretty clear, right? You got to write good code, and you need to create the right automated tests.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Testers, find defects right away. Get some ad hoc testing in there. Support maybe a manual to an automated pipeline if you can, if it's something you can automate. Operations, non-functional requirements. Get those in early so the devs can code them in. I mean, mm-hmm. be involved right at the get-go. Build that dev test support, that build, deploy, test pipeline, that continuous delivery pipeline you saw, get the production analytics in.
Mm-hmm. And I think a really big piece of this is fast feedback, right? It's quality, right? We have quality gates at every single stage. But I think another important thing to note is that each stage, when you find a defect or when you find an automated test that's not working anymore, that's failing now, if you catch it earlier, the cheaper it is to fix.
Yeah.
Right. So the longer you wait for that quality gate to happen, right? Like, let's say BAs and devs don't do a lot of quality, and then we give it to the QA and it's their job. That's now really expensive to fix everything that they find, right? Whereas had we been doing quality and we caught some things earlier on, would have been really, really cheap and quick and easy to fix, right? If I wrote some code and I had a +1 instead of a +2, if I had some unit tests, some reasonable unit tests, I would have caught that and fixed that immediately. Whereas that, you know, if we have a long pipeline before it gets to the testers, they find that. Now we have to go back, find the code, figure out why I put 1 instead of 2, and I don't even know if it's a typo anymore.
Right, yeah, because you might have actually been thinking through the process and you thought it had to be a 1. Mm-hmm. Now you have to re-get all of that context. Yeah, get those, I love that, fast feedback, right? I love that, that's exactly right. Unit test, feedback measured in milliseconds. Manual testers that are sitting by the development team. Testers, feedback measured in hours. User acceptance testing, feedback measured in potentially days. Mm-hmm. You don't want to wait a long time. Stakeholders, they are responsible for providing fast feedback. This is critical, and it's the hardest thing for a lot of development teams to get is that stakeholder engagement, that relationship with their customers that allows them to go out and just ask those questions. Will you look at this and give me feedback? And for the stakeholders to feel free to log into that user acceptance environment, check it out, and potentially start sending back ideas, bugs, failures, change requests, all of the things that they can provide back to the users. So let's just go through what a couple of these things might look like. First would be quality requirements. Requirements starts start that whole quality chain.
Yeah.
Things like acceptance test-driven development. If you have a requirement and you don't have what it takes to make that requirement come to life acceptably, you probably need to add some acceptance tests.
Yeah.
It's got to be measurable. And we want to go through this quick build, measure, learn cycle as quickly as we can. Now let's flip over to code. And when we talk about quality code, we're talking things like unit tests, test-driven development, code coverage, static code analysis, code clone detection.
There's so many things.
Yes.
There's so many tools and different things that you can use to check your code quality, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like if you happen to have Visual Studio Ultimate, you've got code, code clone is in...
Code clone analysis.
Code clone, is that Ultimate? And then the other is code lens. Yeah. But just this ability to just see right in your code, kind of a heads-up display, what's happening in your code. And I love that fast feedback and those features.
I mean, there's so many tools that it's almost silly to think that quality should be pushed off to somebody else, right?
You know, right.
It almost doesn't make sense anymore.
Absolutely, a lot in code. When we get to testing, things like continuous integration. So we're looking at bringing various branches together so that we can test what's this gonna look like together. Manual testing, exploratory testing, code coverage of your manual tests. That's sometimes useful.
Yeah.
Ops, quality operations and infrastructure. We talked about these early. Non-functional requirements, get them in. A lot of times people treat them as an afterthought. We need to make sure that the processing of all of the data for the reports comes in less than 10 minutes. Well, if we didn't know that when we were building the pipeline, it might take something like 2 hours to get through all of that. You know, get those in early. Let us understand so that lets people know what do we need to do, what trade-offs do we need to make as a development and test team, possibly as a BA team, to meet those operational requirements. So one step up, I'm gonna call out the C-level executives, and they are also very responsible. For those, that's the CEO, CIO, the CXO, basically.
Yeah.
The senior leadership. They are responsible for providing clarity, allowing teams to self-organize, but within a context where they're given clear, consistent guidance, and more importantly, repeating that guidance and reinforcing that guidance for the teams. They need to prioritize. If you are in a leadership position and you do not prioritize, what's happening is the prioritization is happening across the board by everyone else on the team, probably inappropriately. So if you don't prioritize, if everything is pry one, then every member on your team is going to pick and work on whatever pry one thing, which is everything, that they think is most interesting. And you probably don't want that if you're trying to reduce your work in process and get stuff out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Change can be good, but chaos is your fault. And the C-level team, I'm calling people out. I have a leadership position at Northwest Cadence. Chaos is my bad. It's my fault if things go crazy. If Lori, who's the president of Northwest Cadence, and I disagree on something, that disagreement doesn't leave the boardroom, basically. We're going to disagree. One of us will say, okay, I disagree, but I'm going to commit to this action, and the executives go out as a unified view of what should happen, even if there's disagreements in the boardroom. Don't use your teams as that leverage across to other teams. And I think I just wanted to elevate that discussion a little bit, because this quality is the executive's responsibility and the manager's responsibility as well. Let's take a look at a couple techniques we can use to get quality. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly so we can jump into a few demonstrations. But the first is acceptance test-driven development, ATDD. It's an oldie but a goodie. This is when you write your requirements, just put in the acceptance tests. Think about them up front. Nobody's doing this, it seems. A group of people are. But if you're not, please do this. Testers, business analysts, get together, write the acceptance criteria right away, up front, before the developers look at it. Because if you as a tester end up writing your own acceptance criteria in the form of test cases after the developers have coded the app, what you are likely to do is not look at the acceptance tests from the value, from the lens of a business analyst or a user. You're likely to look at the acceptance criteria as being a reflection of the technical implementation that the testers have already delivered. And you don't want that. Testers need to test business functionality, not the technical implementation that the developers built.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Absolutely.
The next, fast feedback. I feel like we've just hit this one again and again and
yeah.
again. But if we have to soapbox on something, it's gonna be fast feedback and value to customers. Those are the things that drive successful software delivery organizations. Turns them into factories. Let's get that code, let's pump it out. And that's fast feedback. Allows you to improve that code delivery. It's collaboration, however, it's not criticism. You will not get anywhere if people are fighting amongst themselves. If the feedback you give is...
That was terrible.
It was, yeah, that was terrible, and it's if it's not in a form that helps elevate people. Mm-hmm. And give up on the futile quest to get requirements right the first time. It just doesn't happen in the vast majority of software delivery. You're gonna navigate a path to get to that right requirement, but it might make several intermediate steps where you're showing something, shipping something potentially, and getting feedback from it, and then adjusting to get the right thing out the door. Failures do good things. James mentioned it earlier, and I probably won't repeat much. They just purchase information. They give you mm-hmm. feedback as to what went wrong, and now you know that one additional way not to build a light bulb or whatever it
yeah.
is you're coding.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Code quality's next. Code quality, devs want to build good code, use their talents for good. I have yet to meet a developer who really wants to just throw out code that's awful. Devs do throw out code that's awful. None of them want to do that. Use their desires to end up driving for good code. Code that tests code, don't forget those unit tests, they're still code. They have to be maintained, they have to be updated. Never, ever let failing tests go by. A failing unit test fails your build. It's not something that fails and you say, oh, we don't have that feature anymore, so just ignore it. Get in there and rip out that unit test. A failure of a unit test or an integration test or anything else should be a big enough deal that you stop what you're doing, fix the bug, or remove that test if it no longer applies.
That's a really good point, because we actually just went through a pretty big update of our web front end, and a bunch of our integration tests started failing after we made the big switch over. We went and looked at it and we're like, well, these don't make sense anymore, because we changed had the behavior in the end. So we had to rip them out, right? And don't be scared to take, like, that's work that you've done. You're not throwing it away. It was useful, you've learned from it, and now you're moving on, right? But it's vastly important to maintain those and make sure everything's clean, right? I went to a customer a couple weeks ago. They had a working build up until around late January, and it just stopped working and no one fixed it. Right?
Wow.
Right? And it's because they weren't using that build to do any packaging or deployment or build or, you know, anything like that. So they didn't really care. They're like, oh yeah, it's been failing since January. No one's looked into it.
Ah,
right?
That gives me shivers. That's just terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey. Use some other talents for good as well, which is reviewing your code. Get in there, review that code. Don't let the failures
build up
or stick there, mm-hmm. and review the code quickly. I think this is critical. Don't let code reviews build up. You may even consider putting a work in process limit on code reviews of 2 for a team of 20 or a team of 8. Just don't let them build up. That's if I write code and James reviews it 2 days later, and I open up that code, I don't know who wrote that stuff. It was terrible code. Who wrote that awful stuff, right? You're out of the context.
Yeah.
You need that code review to happen in measured in minutes, maybe hours, but certainly not measured in days. And that's hard because James, to do that code review, has to break away from what he's doing to get the code review done. Okay, soapbox theory time. I'm breaking James's concentration and he's working on something important and I need to break him out of that to do a code review. I probably won't if he's in deep flow and he's working, but I'm gonna be pretty aggressive about getting that. And why? Because the code he's working on is further back in the pipeline than the code review that I want him to conduct. I'm done with my code. It's closer to production. You need to focus on the things closer to production more than you focus on things early in the pipeline. You need to focus on getting things done, not on starting new things. Stop starting, start finishing. So focus on the other end of the flow. I'll hop off my soapbox now.
I love that quote.
It's a good one.
It is.
And let's move on to some other environments, like dev test environments. The same just faster generally doesn't work. When you start getting these automated dev builds that go out to test environments, wow. I mentioned it's magic pixie dust. It's magic pixie dust because it forces people to change. They need a new process. This 2 months of doing regression testing at every test build doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. If you do a test build every week, you can't be testing longer than a week, really. Mm-hmm. You need to get this faster feedback. So you have to figure out how to more effectively test things and do less rote testing, maybe more exploratory and automated testing behind the scenes. Needs new skills. You might have to do things like write feature flags so that you can shut off features that go into production. Feature flags are a way that I can write a bunch of code behind the scenes, get it into production. It goes right into the master branch or main branch, gets built and goes to production. But until that feature flag is turned on, nobody sees it. This is often called branching by feature flag, right? You can have one branch, but you branch by having feature flags that aren't turned on when you get to production. So you can deploy the code, but not release that code. Other things, write some monitoring hooks, do some real-time diagnostics, get things happening out there. And a lot of times that's gonna require some new tools, mm-hmm. things potentially like application insights or potentially building some feedback mechanisms that are custom made for your application. Next, dev test, DevOps, what does all this mean? Both on the same side of this, both sides, opposite sides of the same coin, right?
Yes.
Dev test, when you get to a dev test environment, it's really easy to get to a dev ops environment. You just got to push to prod mm-hmm. and make that extension. One thing, continuous requires delivery. So if you're going to be at this continuous delivery shop, you got to ship code and you got to ship it often and repeatedly out to a production-like environment, a prod-like environment. Non-functional tests, let's get this right out here. If you have non-functional requirements, those need to be in a production-like environment so you can test them. You may not be able to test the scaling requirements that you have in a test environment where all of the services are on one or maybe two boxes, whereas in production you go to 10 or 15 different boxes. So make sure you get those non-functional requirements tested in a production-like environment. Continuous integration is great. A lot of people say they're doing continuous integration when they have a build that kicks off, but they've got so many branches that are so long-lived, you can't call them continuous integration. You can call them continuous compilation. It's not really integration, right? But even that, it's not as good as a build, deploy, test. Get your CI builds, move to a build, deploy, then move to a build, deploy, test environment. And then build the pipeline so you can test out not just the code, but testing the configuration of the infrastructure and the infrastructure itself as well. Tough to do, so not saying it's easy, but it's very, very important. And so something that needs to get done at a priority. I think it's a very high priority, maybe more so than delivering a lot of the features that you have sitting on your backlogs. we're building a product, I mentioned, Visual Cadence. And when we built it, we had to make the call. Do we invest in this continuous delivery pipeline? And or do we build features that our customers want? And that's a hard call to make. But we felt that fast feedback was so fundamental and foundationally important to the way we could deliver software in the future that we built it right off the get-go. Someone asked in the questions how long it took to build it. It took a weekend to build it, 2 days, and it was over a weekend, had kind of a high-pressure release coming up, and we really needed that full end-to-end pipeline, and one of the folks on the team said, I'll throw it together. Shad, Tim, very sharp guy, pulled it together in 2 days, which really was pretty impressive to get that done in two days. If we had to do it again, it would probably take longer. We've built onto it considerably. So
Over months,
right? Little pieces here and there.
It's vastly more complex than it used to be.
Right.
Yeah. So that's just going to happen over time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But we haven't felt it because we've made these small incremental investments. Mm-hmm. That 1 2-day big upfront investment, plus a couple 4-hour investments, 2-hour investments, 30-second investments as we've gone through that pipeline. So you get that. If you have a really slow build or deploy, it's probably a smell, might want to speed it up. And I think now's a good time to jump into a demonstration. Now this is one we're gonna tag team on this demonstration, and I'm gonna start by going out to that Nirvana Visual Studio Online site. We can take a look at it here. And I'm gonna show the first thing is some acceptance criteria. And I've got a work item up here. This is one that we have recently worked on. It's create our MVP layout. That's the minimum viable product in Aurelia. We just recently, James mentioned, moved from a kind of an MVC to a single page app, which also uses MVC as a framework, but rather than going back to the servers often. So we moved to Aurelia. And if you look here, you see, I think, some key things. When we did this, we said, what goes into the minimum viable product? What's the smallest thing we can work on? And we went out and took an image, drew something on a whiteboard, stuck in an image here. You can see the image here. I think most importantly is on the right, the acceptance criteria. And we say we want the team project collection. This tool gathers data from Team Foundation Server on premises and provides executive level reporting, basically. So we have the team project collection navigation on the left. The account admin page needs to be linked from there as well. We need team project navigation next to that. If there's a Cadence Core submenu is present, we need to open it. If it's not present, it still appears in the resulting page, whatever. That's kind of a piece. Requirements CFD is full width of the reporting window. The control chart and box plot are half size. I mean, we're specifying these, and these are the acceptance criteria, what it means to be done. And notice the pluses. These mean these need to be done.
For this to be done.
For this to be done, those have to be done. You need a check mark on every single one of those. But notice, we scroll down, and there's another piece here, and it says, hey, don't do the zero or O items, but if they're already done, don't spend time cutting them. So these are things that, you know, it's kind of nice to have, and if they already just appear out of the box, we're going to leave them. But if it takes effort, we're not going to build them. So anything with that O is, you know, if it's super fast, go ahead and do it. But if it's not there, don't worry about it. That is this important part of prioritizing and scoping. Remember, we talked about the importance of limiting your batch sizes. We want something small we can get to production quickly. Then we'll come back and fill it with some of these things. And maybe if you look further down, some of the minus things. The minus things are the hardcore ones that we might want at a future date, but we absolutely, positively do not want now. And we designate those by putting a minus sign. We don't want the work item query language filtering, that we don't even want that to appear in the MVP.
Yep.
If it's already there, rip it out. Take work to rip it out, because these things cannot appear. That's an idea, and we didn't build this for this presentation. This isn't built for the MVA. We pulled one that was just an actual requirement so that you can see the kind of that level of granularity and the level of detail. For the one James implemented at the very beginning when we got interrupted by Lori and had to swap that thing out, it was much different. We didn't have any pictures of it. We didn't have much at all. All we did was two pieces of acceptance criteria and off to deliver it. Mm-hmm. Put the right amount of detail in the right things.
And I think another important thing to note is that that specific backlog item has actually changed since it's been completed. Mm-hmm. Right? Like there's a big, you know, that was a pretty big investment. But since then, even some of those acceptance criteria and future backlog items have changed. Right? So it's that idea of we get something out there, it's not going to be perfect,
yep.
But we're going to refine it as time goes on.
Yeah, in fact, the UI for the MVP actually changed. We didn't reflect it here, but there was a change when someone says, instead of two columns, can we do a bar at the top and one column? And we're like, oh, that looks even better.
Yeah.
Perfect. We'll use that for our MVP. It's an invitation to a conversation, and I think that's the important thing here, is it was an invitation to give a call to Shad, to Colin, to me, to James, and say, what do we really mean by this, and can we do this? And off it goes. So that's that acceptance criteria. Notice there's no non-functional requirements here. We don't have any non-functional requirements that we needed for this one, so they're not included. Mm-hmm. If they are, make sure they're in the acceptance criteria. Whew. James, back to you. He talked about the next things.
Perfect. So another piece of quality that you can kind of build in, and this is still kind of from the BA's perspective, is visuals, right? That was a lot of text, but you also noticed that there was a screenshot of a whiteboard that we had, right? Which gives us a lot of contextual clues as to what, you know, the end product should look like.
Picture says 1,000 words,
yeah,
right?
That kind exactly. of a... So there's a great tool that comes with Microsoft's Team Foundation server called Storyboarding. And Storyboarding is great because it actually just piggybacks on PowerPoints, and everybody knows PowerPoints, right? I've been building PowerPoints since I was like 7. I'm very familiar with the product. What they do is if we hop onto my screen here, they give us a little tab up here called Storyboarding. Right, which is really, really cool. And if we just show this real quick, this is our user management page. This is the page that we saw earlier on. Notice that there is an add user. The add user form is still down below. Mm-hmm. Right. So had Steve wanted to just add this in as part of the requirement, he would have just added this in, go to the next slide and say, hey, can you move this to the top of the page?
Yep.
Right, just like that. And just all I had to do was just, you know, cut and paste in an image.
Yeah, and the nice thing is it's not just PowerPoint out of the box.
Yeah.
Some of those images, like you saw the top had the web URL and whatnot. If he grows the size of this PowerPoint image, that stays nice and skinny. So it's a smart art kind of a thing.
Yeah, and let's really actually show some of those.
Yeah, it might
be worth
it.
So like if I drag out a new image, it's completely empty here, mm-hmm. right? So let's say I'm working on some sort of web browser site. So I just drag that onto here. And ta-da, drag it out, and now we have a web page.
Yeah.
Just like that. I can add some other things like a data grid on here, right? Or let's say a calendar. Oops. Right? Drag a calendar. I want a calendar up here. I want a breadcrumb up in the top left, right? And you can do this really, really, really easily and save it, right?
Yep.
You can put in animations, right? I want to be able to go from this mouse, or I want to have this click go from here. Oops, missed that. There we go. From there, all the way over here, and click this text button like that. And if we go to that, now we just go in here and hit the next button, and it goes up and says click. Right? So we can get really easy animations and storylines with PowerPoint just using the out-of-box functionality. Right?
I have to say, both of us are we mentioned MVPs. And so we get to sit on some of the forward-looking stuff, some of the mm-hmm. councils where Microsoft will say, here's what's coming in the next version of Visual Studio or TFS, and this is what they use. And it's really engaging because we see the visual, they'll have the mouse move, click, moves to another screen. Mm-hmm. We can follow through very easily. Yeah. Is it appropriate everywhere? Absolutely not. Use the appropriate tool. When we had the stuff that James and I did earlier, we didn't need any kind of photograph or anything, although maybe we should have because we would have noticed the notes bar.
Yep.
But it wasn't appropriate for that. Mm-hmm. But when we're coming up with something new, great. And not just useful to show the development team what to do, more useful to go to your customers and get that fast feedback. What's the cheapest thing you can do and fastest thing to get feedback? Build a mock-up, show it to them, walk them through it, and let them give you their feedback. They may say, no, I don't want that, or that's not at all the UI I would expect to see. Mm-hmm. And you get that feedback early before the developers have even worked on anything.
I also think it gives the business analysts or whoever's creating this sort of storyboard, it forces them to think about what the end product should look like, right? What does it look like to be completely done with this feature? And it really kind of ties right into that acceptance criteria where let's build the storyboard and then the acceptance criteria will fall out of that built storyboard because we know exactly what we want it to look like, right?
Yep.
Cool. So another really cool thing here is not just creating these storyboards in PowerPoint, but you can actually link them back to the work items, right? Just like everything else in TFS, just that traceability comes right back. So if we pop down back into my screen, there's a link up here that just says storyboard links. And if I click that, it'll connect up to my team project, and I just say, hey, let's link this to something. And I can go and find a query, I can give it an ID, I'll just give it 511, the one that Steve was showing. Say, fine, there it is, and click tick box, okay. And that's it. And now they're linked up. And now Steve can, now when I open up that work item, there's gonna be a storyboard link right there, and I can just double click that, open it up, and it'll open this up for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really, really easy, right? So quality in, right at the very beginning.
In fact, if you pop over to my screen, you can actually see it. I actually opened up 5.11, and there's the storyboards. It looks like you did one test one up here, mm-hmm. User management, and then here's the new one you just published.
Yep.
And it's right there. I can double click it, open it, and now I see it, and I'm right in the storyboard, mm-hmm. Right as a developer, as a tester, as someone giving feedback.
Perfect.
Excellent. What else is new? That's for the business analyst. Let's talk about what tools are available for developers.
Yeah, perfect. So let's jump into Visual Studio, right? So that's typically where developers are going to spend most of their time. Integrated development environment. It should have the tools that you need to do quality built into the code versus after the fact, right? So if we jump in, I think the biggest change that was made, and this was mainly in 2012, was the Test Explorer, right? And this is so great and it's so nice. And they rebuilt MS Test from the ground up when they redid this, right? It's faster, it's easier to use, it has more functionality than it used to. It supports async tests, right? Lots of different things that it used to not support. Again, I think one of my favorite things is this run tests after every single build. So if I go in here and say, I want to change something in some sort of thing here and just say, enter, and I just say, hey, build my solution. It'll build my solution, it'll find all the tests, and it's gonna run all the tests, right? Simple as that. Fast feedback, constant quality checking as we go along, right? Really, really, really nice to have that, right? Really cool part about the unit test, this Test Explorer, is that you can actually plug in a bunch of different unit test frameworks, right? XUnit, NUnit, all these sorts of things actually get populated. I was working on a Python solution the other day, and I created a Python unit test module, and sure enough, I built, and those Python tests just showed up in the Unit Test Explorer, and I could run them right there. It's kind of nuts how pluggable it is right now. Right out the gate, there were only a handful of different frameworks that plugged into it, but I think almost I haven't run into one that doesn't plug into it anymore, which is really, really cool. Cool, so with that, we also have some other features in here, right? So one of them is, it's for some reason not running some other tests down there, but that's okay. But what we can do is we can run analyze code coverage for all the tests. As easy as that, right? I know a lot of companies are saying, hey, how do we get code coverage? Like, how do we enable it? You can just run it right here and just say, hey, give me code coverage for everything.
Nice.
And it'll just give it to you. Just like that. For some reason, it's not running these other tests.
Are those your JavaScript tests?
Yeah, so these are Jasmine tests, and I'll show you how to run those in a second, but it looks like they're being picked up here in the Test Explorer, right?
Right.
I think we've been having problems running these via Test Explorer. I'll show you how we run them. But typically, once you run this, it gives you a code coverage report. You can look into, you can drill down into each module, you can drill down into classes. You can actually hit this toggle switch, which will actually highlight your code blue or red, depending on whether or not it's been unit tested or not, right? So let's say we have a method that has an if else in it. If you have a unit test that tests one if, but not the else, the if will be blue, the else will be red, right? You haven't hit that yet. Cool. Some other things that we can do here. One of the really cool things here is a code clone analysis, which is really sweet. So I can come in here and say, run code clone analysis for my project or just across the solution. So I just go ahead and run code clone analysis.
I'm a little nervous, to be honest.
Haven't done it yet, so we'll see what happens. But again, it triggers a build, and it runs code clone analysis. Or did I just did code analysis. This is just static code analysis, which is another feature. Right? Static code analysis, which is just basically things like if it's iSerializable, give it a, you know, add the serializable attribute to it. You know, things like that to make your code kind of complete from the perspective of a developer, right? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And we only have two. That's not bad at all.
It's not bad at all.
And they're both just serializable. Oh, it's still going.
Shucks.
No code analysis issues were detected.
Good.
Interesting. Cool. So we have those. We can change the settings on those, make them more rigid or less rigid, right? Depending on what we want and what's acceptable for our team. So let's actually run code clone analysis. Here we go. Analyze solution for code clones, right there. Let's click that. And what this does, it actually goes off of an algorithm that was developed to catch plagiarism in code for universities.
Really?
Yeah, so they transformed it, and now it you can do strong matches for things that have similar code, right? A lot of these similar codes are in our testing, our unit testing, right? Which are going to have a lot of asserts and that sort of thing. But it gives you strong matches. We don't have any exact matches, which is good. That's an exact replica of code that we could probably easily refactor. But it gives you a really good idea on how to come in here and say, hey, how do we make our code more modular, more easier to test, easier to change, right? Rather than having three or four different places where the code's exactly the same, you have one place. And if you need to change it, fix it, update it, add new things to it, you go to that one place versus going to three or four different places to get it working, right?
Dry code.
Dry.
Don't repeat yourself.
Yes.
DRY. Don't repeat yourself.
Cool. And then one more thing. You saw those JavaScript tests, but let's actually run them. So we've gone into this thing called Gulp. And I'm just going to, this very quickly, Gulp is a technology that we're using to transpile our TypeScript files, compile our less files, and run JavaScript tests, right? Minify JavaScript files, that sort of thing. So rather than letting Visual Studio do it, we let Gulp do it because we can call Gulp from the command line and let it run on team build. The great thing about Gulp is that, what's the other one? Gulp and?
Grunt.
Grunt. Gulp and Grunt. Grunt. They're both languages that allow you to do tasks such as these, right? I'm going to be using this thing called Task Runner. It's a Task Runner Explorer. It's a free extension. The cool thing in Visual Studio 2015 is that Grunt and Gulp are both supported out of box.
Yeah.
This is kind of the way that it's going to do transpiling, compiling of JavaScript and less files. But one of our tasks in our Gulp file is a unit test task. So if it's down here and I just right click and run it, it will actually run through all of my JavaScript tests. You'll see it pop open Chrome, run the tests in Chrome, and it will give me a build report or a test report after the fact, right?
Nice.
So you can see here that in source, NWC web, test, coverage, Chrome, we can go look at that. So I'm just going to open that up here and go into Chrome, and it gives you this nice report. Just like that. Not as good code coverage as we have in some of our C# modules,
yep.
But you can see we can do code coverage everywhere, right? There's a lot of different testing tools and quality tools built into Visual Studio, or you can plug into Visual Studio very easily.
Cool. That's cool. That's the first time I've ever seen that. I'm a sponsor for the development. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
I know you just do absolutely wonderful things, though, in that coding. Wow, that was cool to see.
Awesome. So just Two more things. So one more thing is the code metrics. So in our analyze context menu, we have a code metrics too. Code metrics are awesome. They measure things like cyclomatic complexity, depth of inheritance, class coupling. And a really cool thing is you can actually get an extension for CodeLens, and I'll show you CodeLens here, that actually has this above every single method. So what you see here is we have our maintainability index, which is an equation based off of these four metrics, is lines of code for the method, class coupling, depth of inheritance, and cyclomatic complexity, right? And if we drill down in here, we can see each one of our different namespaces, and inside those namespaces, we can see specific classes and even specific method calls, which is kind of crazy.
Yep.
Up here, you'll see that we have a method call. We have, you know, six references to that method. We have Collins made a change to it on 228. Right, two changes there. There is an extension called the CodeLens extension that actually puts another little bar and another little highlight there that actually has the maintainability index and how much it's gone up or down depending on what code's changed since you've opened the file.
Love it. That's CodeLens, by the way. That little piece that occurred right up above that. It's just right above the method signature, right above all sorts of things. It just kind of appears.
Yeah, this little thing right here. This is CodeLens.
Yep. Oh, there it is, maintainability 100. Scroll down. It's in there.
Oh, yeah,
it's
there it is. Oh, sorry, that's on the class. That's
on
why.
On the class, yep.
There it is, maintainability 100.
Nice.
Just like that.
That's easily maintained.
Another really cool thing is if we actually find a method that's specifically tested via our unit tests, we'll see whether it's passing or failing. So let's actually see if we can do that real quick. So if we jump in here, find by row key. Oh, these are all mocked out, so we may not be able to find something. But if you have unit tests that actually hit those methods, you'll get how many are passing or failing right up there in the code lens too, indicating did I make some changes to my code that failed some regression unit tests, or are they still all passing? Right there in the code menu.
I absolutely love that feature. I'm addicted because it gives me a heads up display right there.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
I couldn't imagine not using it anymore after I've used it for so long.
Yeah, it's that fast feedback. Once again, getting that fast feedback. Now we've dove into that developer piece. What about operations?
Operations, cool. So one of the big things for operations is kind of monitoring, right? It's kind of almost a reactive step. So you have to have a lot of metrics coming in and a constant stream of things going on. So if we jump over to our Application Insights, so this is for our developer, the development environment. So we have Application Insights for every single one of our environments. This one's specifically for the development environment. We get things like average server response time out, you know. We get browser page load. How long does it take to load one of the browser pages? Server requests. How many were there? 1,600. Yeah, 1,600. Okay, yeah. And then how many of those were failed, right? And we can drill into these really easily and say, hey, what's failing over here? And we can go take a look at what were the request names, that sort of thing. And if we scroll down here, we'll actually see which ones fail the most. And we can actually go in and see, we should be able to see why they actually failed or what was the actual status code, status error. Oh, maybe not. But you can see all that sort of stuff. You can see what the slowest responses are, right? We have one up here that's 9,000 milliseconds. That's 9 seconds to load that.
Right, but remember, that's under our API.
Yes.
We're uploading a pretty massive data file at that point.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just a good way to see, you know, are we seeing slow requests that shouldn't be slow requests? Are we seeing a particular route fail constantly when it shouldn't, you know, maybe we should highlight that, right? Get exceptions, right? Usage statistics. How many users are we getting? How many sessions do we have? How many page views do we get with those users? That sort of thing, right? What are the browser? What's the average session duration? And then we actually have custom events that we have in here, right? Like how many custom events, how many times is the box plot loaded? How many times is the requirements CFD loaded? So on and so forth, right? So you can have just great out-of-box metrics, as well as you can pump in your own custom events and slice and dice off of those however you want.
That's pretty impressive. That is Application Insights. That's a feature of Azure,
yes,
specifically, not
yes,
necessarily anything else. That's just something in Azure that helps monitor apps running locally or on premises or in Azure.
Yep.
Yep, ours runs all in Azure.
But. Yeah, and there's a lot. There's other tools out there that do that sort of thing too.
Sure, mm-hmm. absolutely. But it's that fast feedback. Mm-hmm. That's what you're trying to achieve when you're using these types of tools.
Yeah, and it's fast feedback everywhere, right? Ops, dev,
everywhere,
QA, anybody.
Absolutely. I think it's time to probably pop back in and continue on. I want to talk about testers and quality assurance. There is a very specific tester responsibility when it comes to code quality. And I think we have to recognize that. It's everybody's responsibility, but the weight of the world sits on the tester's shoulders to make sure that everyone else has done their job and that we are pushing good code to production. That last step, that quality assurance, that validation step. If we take a look at the traditional quality assurance process, it's kind of messy. We start with defining the things, and we go from define, development, and then the testers, down there, the QA and UAT is really, a lot of times, post-implementation. Generally very manual, limited automation. UAT is post, user acceptance testing is post-implementation as well. Then there might be some pre-deployment verifications done by operations. This is all done after the fact, and that causes a lot of problems. You've got late engagement of stakeholders. You have late detection of unmet requirements, increased cycle times, increased costs, lower quality. We could go on and on and on and on. In a modern life cycle, it's everywhere. The testers are involved right at the definition where they're starting to build those acceptance tests. So the business analysts might be defining those acceptance criteria, but the testers are going to be building those acceptance tests. We're going to go into implementation, development implementation, where there's continuous acceptance testing going on. We're going to go into testing in production. I'll probably talk about this a little bit later. I love this idea, but always a little bit on everyone's danger radar when we talk about pushing things into production and then doing our testing. And then operations, doing MTTR, mean time to repair reduction. So how fast can we repair code? I want to talk about test case execution, particularly while we're on this slide. Notice continuous acceptance testing is in develop. I firmly believe requirements are built. They're sitting in a backlog, and they've got their acceptance criteria listed. When we commit to that work, developers and testers should both get to work, and testers right away need to be converting those acceptance criteria into test cases or executable acceptance criteria. And why do they want to do it upfront? Well, first, they're not going to be doing it against the technical implementation that the developers are building, but instead, they will be building it against the business value thought up by the business analyst. More importantly, however, maybe not more importantly, but other importantly, is that the developers, while they are writing the code and before they commit and ask for that pull request, they can run those acceptance tests themselves. Every developer, you will not talk to a developer who does not push F5 and walk through their code before committing anything of consequence. They're going to walk through the code. They're going to run the happy path in the code. Why not give them that ability to push F5 and then run through your entire suite of unit tests? Your entire suite of manual tests that the testers have defined. Then they check it in and two things happen. One, the developer knows when they're done, so there's less chance of gold plating. Hey, all the tests pass. Secondly, the testers have a warm fuzzy because they have already had the code being run and executed successfully before it got merged to master and pushed off into their test environments. It's a win-win all around, as long as those developers have access to those testing tools. All right. Next, quality enablement at every level. We're not talking a lot of tooling, really. I mean, we're doing everything in Visual Studio. It's our tool of choice, right? And MTM. But here's some tools that show kind of that end-to-end areas where we've got to think about quality. Everything from user testing with the feedback client through unit testing, performance testing, lab management, test planning, work item tracking, all of these things are engaged in our quality enablement practice. And I want to talk about traceability. You really have hit it, James, and nailed it, how the importance. Let me talk about it. I come up with a storyboard, some idea. And that storyboard, I send out and get some feedback, maybe from some stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And that might turn into a backlog item or a requirement. These are all linked. And remember, that requirement turns into test suites right away. Mm-hmm. We don't code it first. And those are part of test plans and are made up of several test cases. Those backlog items are also decomposed, potentially, mm-hmm. if you want to do that, into tasks that the developers
process.
Execute. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We don't use tasks in general, mm-hmm. but you could. Those tasks are related to change sets or commits, mm-hmm. or the backlog items are. Those commits have code reviews or pull requests against them. Also, they're associated with a particular build. Those builds are associated with test plans.
Yep.
Critical linkage now back. So we can see what have we tested against what builds. And those test cases, it may result in automated tests that get executed. And all of those may, of course, result in operational issues. This is kind of a very shallow look at the depth of TFS and all of the mm-hmm. Linkages. There's a lot more linkages, but these are some of the key ones that can elevate through and help the testers. I'm going to just talk one real briefly. If a tester is doing a bunch of manual tests against a particular build, and that build is the .NET 2.0 or higher application, and they're running all these manual tests against this build using the MTM, the Microsoft Test Manager tool, when you create a new build, it's possible to configure MTM to alert you and say, hey, you know, you ran these 25 manual tests that all passed, but they touched a piece of code that was now changed by the developer. And three of these you should probably rerun again because the code underlying the methods called by your manual tests has changed. That's where this traceability becomes really, really powerful. All right, traceability and flow. Let's move to some actionable feedback, some tools that you might use. Here's a report. This is a stories overview. It shows things like the title of the story, how many hours you've completed, how many are remaining, what are the test results looking like, what's passing, what's failing, are there bugs, active or resolved, logged against it. James, you actually built this, mm-hmm. but you built it as a demo. And thank goodness, because if I saw anything like this,
I'd be a bit worried.
Yeah, I'd be freaking out, right? I would be freaking out. Yeah. Why? Because it looks like we're working on way too many things. Why should we have all these test results failing? We should be working on 2, 3, maybe 4 items at a time on a team our size.
Yeah.
So we really wouldn't want to see something like this. But I do like a couple of these things. Notice those little light green lines. There's dark green and light green. That's recently completed. Mm-hmm. Stuff you've worked on in the last 3 days. And James, it looked like this team may have been spreading their effort all over the place. Bad juju there. They don't want to do that. Here's the testing toolbox. Some things for you to consider as a tester. There's the data, just the data you sit on top of, the automated testing, things like unit, integration, performance, load. You can go up, you might do keyword testing, UI automation testing, performance testing, and you get to the pinnacle, the top of this pyramid, where you're doing the important things like user testing, ad hoc exploratory testing, some planned manual tests, and then on the right side, all this continuous integration piece. That allows you to do that testing. I have to briefly talk before we step mm-hmm. to your demo about testing in production. Because testing in production is one of those things that's relatively, people have done it for a long time, not necessarily intentionally, but now it's something gaining more and more acceptance, especially with the advent of the cloud. So for instance, you may have your application running on and serving up, you know, 1,000 people a minute or an hour or a day or whatever. But what you can do with testing in production, if you have a tool like Azure has a new testing in production capability, you can spin up a new environment, sit side by side, and then when you activate testing in production, you say we want 98% of all the requests to go to my old application and 2% to go to my new application. And so those 2% of people are going to get redirected into the new environment. Now that new environment, they do their work there, and then you use something like Application Insights to compare side by side what's the activity like on the old ones per server and on the new ones per server. And if it looks like something's wildly off, like James showed you the custom thing that said, here's how many cumulative flow diagrams people have looked at and how many cycle time metrics. If nobody is looking at those cumulative flow or cycle time metrics on the new version, even though only 2% of the people are there, we probably have a problem that we need to look at. So these types of tools and capabilities are starting to find their way into tools like Azure that can provide them out of the box. You could, of course, build your own infrastructure to do that, but I love the fact that Azure's providing that. They call it testing in production, but frankly, I think the other thing to use it for is A/B testing. Yeah. You have a metric you want to track, how many people click through when I use this term versus this term, or have this UI versus this UI. Split it 50-50 between the two UIs, gather metrics, and choose which one you want to go with. Mm-hmm. Some interesting stuff coming. Anyway, testing in production, crazy maybe, but if you're in a place like Azure or you've got a continuous delivery pipeline, why not? If something goes bad, bang, roll back or spin out a new version in minutes. Mm-hmm. Right? Fix it and get the new version out. Yep. All right, over to you, James, to show off some of this Microsoft Test Manager.
Perfect. So we've been talking a lot about quality and a lot of automation mainly, especially in the DevOps module that we just did. But there is a place for manual testing, right? One of our processes is bringing on new clients, and we do have an automated way to bring them on, but we still have to do some sort of manual validation, right? So what we've done is we've actually created some test plan with some test suites and test cases in it in order to validate that the new account process actually worked. So if we jumped into my laptop here, we'll see that I have Microsoft Test Manager open. We have a new customer test plan, right? New customer, new account, and we have some test suites, right? Verify customer permissions are there, verify report generation is happening, verify technical components are working appropriately. So what I want to do is just kind of rip open one of these things and kind of show you what it looks like. Oh, an exception has been thrown. Interesting. Let's try that again. Okay. Well, that's not working, so let's go take a look at it on the website. So on the web, which is another plug right into the testing tools, we have our test suite up here, test plans and test cases. And the really cool thing about this is that we can actually run these from the web itself. But let's open one up and take a look at it. So if we open this up and we look at it here, we can see, just open a browser, go to the companyid.visualcadence.com, go to the report page, choose teams, and then select a team, and then close the web browser. Our expected result is we should just have some reports for that team on that page. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to run it right here to make it nice and easy. So I just hit run test. It gave me a pop-up blocked. I'm going to allow all pop-ups and try that one more time. Great, brings it up. You'll notice this actually looks very similar to the feedback client, right? Pops open some stuff over on the left-hand side, and we're good to go. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring this in and actually go to our demo site and verify this. So I'm going to come in, open a web browser, did that. I'm going to go to the company, so just demo.visualcadence.com. Let it load. Sweet, it loaded. Go to the report page. So go to the report. It's going to have me log in. Log in. And just like that, I'm going to go to the default collection and then choose teams. Our workflow has changed a little bit. We haven't updated the test case because we just did a big rewrite of the web, right? So again, maintaining tests and is not just specific to unit tests, but it's also manual tests. And as you can see, we're a little bit behind here.
Yep.
So now we choose a team from here and just make sure that everything loads appropriately, right? So I'm going to click catalog. And catalog, it looks like all the reports load up just like that. There's our cumulative flow diagram, our scatter plot, our control chart, and our box plot, right? So it looks like all the reports are loading. That's cool. And then close web browser. I'm just going to close this tab. And once we're done, we're done. And we can hit save and close. And once we do that, we can see that the outcome of that test has passed, right? So really cool. If we weren't getting those exceptions in MTM, we could actually run the exact same thing inside of MTM. But MTM allows for you to collect diagnostics as well, right? So you can collect things such as code coverage, how much code you covered based off that manual test that you did. You can get things such as IntelliTrace logs. You can do video and audio recordings. You can do things such as test impact analysis, right? There's a ton of different things. You can actually write your own custom adapters to collect your own diagnostics information if you want to. The possibilities are pretty endless there. One more really cool thing with MTM that I'm going to show you is this idea of exploratory testing. So in exploratory testing, we don't have a particular test case or a particular flow that we're walking through, a set of steps that we're walking through, a scenario. What our job to do is basically, how can we break it, right? Because if we can break it, then you know the end clients are definitely going to break it, right? So Our idea about doing an exploratory test is, hey, I'm just going to go and mess about on the application and see what breaks. Report bugs if I do it. So if we jump onto my screen here, and we do, there's this little link here that says do exploratory testing, right? What we can do is we can actually choose a particular work item to do exploratory testing against, or we can just explore by, you know, on our own. So I'm just going to hit explore and let it do on its own. As you can see here, we get this window that's exactly the same as we had with the web browser, except this time, the really cool thing with this is that it is actually going to be collecting stuff on the back end, depending on what settings I've set up. I think I just have bare minimum, so it's not going to record a lot, but I'll just go ahead and start. Awesome. You'll see it's a little different here. Rather than having steps, we just have a blank page. So I'm going to go back to demo and see what I can break. Right? Log in, access it, dashboard, there's nothing. Nothing shows up.
I think that sounds like a bug.
That looks like a bug to me. So what I can do is I can just say, add a screenshot. Let it load. Might be a little slow here. Oh.
Or it might not let you. It might not give you, you might have to click it again.
Yeah, so I may have changed my default screenshot from the out-of-box Windows one to a custom one that is not started right now. So so that might not pop up right now, but that's because I made some modifications. And it looks like I froze MTM. But
it's coming back.
Yeah, it's still going.
Waiting for the application under test. You might want to go back. It might be something else.
Yeah. Let's just close it and see if we can end the process.
And if not, I also have been moving along. I haven't quite gotten as far as you, but I also have
perfect
the tests, and I can hit explore, and I can start kind of where you left off. So if we take a look at my screen, I'm now in the same
perfect
boat, and I'm going to start this. Although mine is kind of squishy,
yeah,
and I don't know why.
I'm
not sure why either. But I'm going to fire it up, and we're going to open it up and head over to demo. Pop into demo. We'll take a look. We'll go back into. I'm going to go somewhere else because that just seemed dangerous to me. I'm going to go ahead and log in, and I'm going to go in and view some reports along this, and probably find something like I don't know. We'll hit the executive backend or something like that. And I might look at this and say something like, you know, I don't like the way the CFD is laid out, or we shouldn't be able to get rid of the closed state. So I'm going to add a screenshot. And in mine, it works. It kind of adjusts things a little bit strangely, but we can grab a screenshot here. And And then I can go ahead and create a bug based on this. So I could say, shouldn't be able to close the closed state. That's kind of a weird sentence, but good enough. And I'll create a bug based on this, and it collects some information and notice the steps that it took to reproduce. I clicked on this, I clicked on this legacy document, I clicked here, clicked here, clicked here. Some of these steps don't necessarily make sense, but I did click on this observation, and here we have it. We have some diagnostics logs. I can kind of see what I was doing. I probably did a lot more clicking than I needed to, and this is bug exists. Oh my goodness, this is in production. We're going to save and create test as part of this demo, and it's going to create some test steps. And I'm going to go in here and say, need to not allow closing of closed state in CFD. Now that's definitely not the case. Or app doesn't, that would be a better way to say it. BAP doesn't allow closing it. And now notice I've got a couple of these things. I'm opened it up in Chrome. I might have been better off opening up this in IE for gathering some of the data behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But I can go in and make some edits here. Did this. You know what I mean? Did this, yeah. Did this. I almost always do this demo pulling it out of TFS, I mean IE,
yeah.
When you get a list of everything you clicked rather than you clicked Chrome,
yep.
Which would be a lot better. And then I provide some expected result. Expected result here is that not allowed to close closed state. And I save and close it. But here's the important thing. I've just walked through, I've created those bugs, and now I can keep drilling through. I can bring back the closed state, I can zoom into things, I can do whatever it is I want to do as I'm walking through this thing, this exploratory test. This is very, very powerful because it's the connectivity. I've automatically created a bug and a test case. Now, if I have to create a lot of test cases against an app that already exists, first of all, probably shouldn't be doing those kind of test cases. But once your test case is there and the app's there and you need to flesh out a test case, I hit an exploratory test. I just walk through. I don't bother creating bugs. I just create new test cases as I go. And it captures all of the steps that I've taken, if I'm in IE. All right, that's exploratory testing in a nutshell. Let's jump back to the PowerPoints and wrap up with one final thought. And that final thought, once again, is that quality is a team sport. Across the board, we've got quality in each and every one of the areas, every column of our Kanban board. And with that, we're going to jump into some questions and lunch. We're going to be coming back in approximately 1 hour. Or probably exactly 1 hour.
Yeah.
And during that time, feel free to jump in and ask us individual questions. You can ask us in here. You can see our Twitter handles there. You can also tweet at us if you want to interact that way.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you all in about an hour.